The 100 Years' War, the Du Guesclin period, schemes to rid France of the companies, part 4. Now, in the eastern part of France, the work of pacification began in the mountains of the Massif Central. For 10 years, the company's chief refuge and base and the great crossroads of their operations. After the departure of Berdicat's and Albert's band to Anse in August of 1365, teams of reformers passed through the Auvergne with military escorts, rounding up the remaining routiers and sending them off for execution, fining, and confiscating the property of those who had dealt with them. In the neighboring province of the Bourbonnais, where the garrisons had never been linked to the great companies, the Duke of Bourbon's lieutenant undertook the systematic reduction of most of the surviving garrisons. Once the mountains had been cleared of the companies, the plain then withered away. In Burgundy, the officers of Philip the Bold had been engaged since 1364 in vigorous purges, executing routiers from the highest to the lowest. The chief agent of this policy was Hugh Obero, bailli of Dijon, an ambitious, low-born official of great energy destined for a famous and ultimately tragic career in royal service. He entered upon the task with special relish. Great numbers of freebooters were drowned, beheaded, or hanged in public spaces of the principal towns. When the routiers fell into the hands of private captors, the Duke's officers were prepared to buy them for large sums in order to make a spectacle of their death. Guillaume de Pin, the Poitevin captain who had operated in Burgundy for several years, was bought for 200 livres and executed in Chalon. His remains were exposed at the pillory for 8 months. Giles Trevachet was purchased and executed at Semur-Auxois. The Duke paid 1,000 gold francs for the person of the Breton routier Jean de Cornelles, who they executed at Dijon. After the departure of Bertrand de Guesclin's army to Spain, there remained two substantial concentrations of routiers in eastern France. The remnants of the archpriest's crusaders quartered in the imperial county along the east bank of the Saone River, and the companies of Beautecat d'Albert, who had refused to go either to Turkey or Spain, and were being contained on the west bank of the river from Chalon to Lyon. Neither group can have found this twilight phase of their existence very profitable. All the towns and castles of any size were carefully defended. River crossings were guarded so as to prevent different groups from joining forces. Deprived of most of their leadership and numbers, they could no longer operate their network of alliances which had made them such a formidable enemy. At the beginning of December in 1365, the leading captains encamped east of the Saone River in the imperial county were persuaded to enter into a fresh treaty with the archpriest in a small village of Condoré near Besançon, by which they undertook to leave the region in return for a modest ransom of 21,000 florins. During the following weeks, those of them who were unwilling to join the crusade against the Turks were escorted under armed guard across the river and contained with the rest in the Mâconnais. Few crusaders were found among the companies of Berdicat on the west bank and were ferried across the river in the opposite direction. Several months passed in trying to arrange the passage of this eastern group to embarkation points in Italy, while the unpaid and unfed troops became progressively more restless and angry. On May the 25th, 1366, the archpriest was murdered in the course of an altercation with some of his men. The whole venture then collapsed, and the eastern group dispersed. As for the western group, they remained a dangerous idleness until they began to disperse. In June, the Duke's officers were ordered to arrest and execute those who remained behind, and a small army was assembled to back them up. By the autumn of 1366, Burgundy was virtually clear of the companies. Most of the Gascons returned to Gascony, where fresh opportunities for soldiering were now opening up. Their leaders are found amongst the retainers of the Prince of Wales later in the year. The rest merged with the population and then vanished from sight. Now, on New Year's Day, 1366, Peter IV of Aragon gave a great feast for the leaders of the routier army in the hall of the Royal Palace of Barcelona. Bertrand de Guesclin sat in a place of honor besides the king. Hugh Caverly and Arnold de Ardham sat side by side at the high table. Assorted bandits were distributed about the hall. During the following days, the troops began to make their way west into the valley of the River Ebro. As they passed, they left regular reminders of the casual violence for which they were notorious. Peter IV received daily reports of their great and irreparable destructions, ranging from petty theft from rural barns to incidents as serious as the sack of Barbastro in Upper Aragon, in which 200 of the inhabitants were burned alive in the tower of the church to which they had fled for safety. It was the largest army that had been seen in the Iberian Peninsula since the great crusades against the Moors more than a century before, and probably larger than the combined military strength of both Castile and Aragon. They became known, like the White Company arriving in Italy in 1362, as the Gente Blanca. Their equipment, organization, and tactics provoked the same awe amongst the inhabitants. Their battle tactics were quite new to the peninsula, whose heavily armed knights took the same disdainful view of the notion of fighting on foot as the French had done in the early 14th century, in spite of the warnings of those who had followed the course of the war in France. "It is their way of crushing their enemy," Peter IV told his son when advising him not on any account to risk battle. The leaders of the army had not forgotten why they had come to Spain and quickly fell in the menacing debate with the hosts about their money. Peter IV had already paid 100,000 florins, which was due them, which he had collected together with much difficulty from the early receipts of special taxes voted by the Cortes and from borrowing. But the captains were not satisfied. They came before the king at Tarragona and asked for more. The sums already received had been distributed to the army, they explained, but fresh companies were still arriving across the Pyrenees. Another 20,000 florins would be required for them. Peter paid half of this sum down and promised the rest later. He had to sell land to do it. Then came another demand for an additional sum representing 3 months' wages in advance, which had not been mentioned before. Individual captains added their own personal requirements. Bertrand de Guesclin had already shown the way. He obtained extensive grants of land and castles and the title of Count. Hugh Cavalli extracted a pension of 2,000 florins a year and grants of land in the Aragonese March. As for the spoil of Castile, de Guesclin and Cavalli reached an agreement about that shortly after their arrival in the peninsula, which was designed to prevent competition for loot between the English and the French divisions of the army. In addition to being paid the wages of his army, which de Guesclin guaranteed, Cavalli was to have a quarter of all the spoils of Castile and de Guesclin the other three quarters. In return for Cavalli's agreement to this unequal division, de Guesclin was to cede everything that he received in grants from Henry of Trastamara. On February the 13th, 1366, the king arrived at Saragossa, the ancient capital of Aragon, which had been appointed as the forward assembly point of the army. He declared himself overjoyed by the spectacle of the great mass of foreign soldiers which the Divine Majesty had sent to aid us against our notorious enemy, and looked forward to the destruction of the King of Castile. The truth was he and his subjects were prisoners of his terrible allies. I'm going to halt here because then we get into the battling and there's not a short way of getting through that. So we'll do some fighting next time. Now the sources for this: Froissart's Chronicles, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylands, and The Hundred Years' War, Volume 2, Trial by Fire by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.